Coming up on 7 days today, is America the right nation? Well, a new book is claiming that the resurgence of American conservatism is unstoppable. So will this triumphant swing to the right in U.S. politics dictate the outcome of November's elections? And Roman holiday was Berlusconi Blair's Italian fiasco. Our panel today are the writer and broadcaster Finola Meredith, Irish news columnist Newton Emerson. They'll both be here for the next 4 weeks. And this week we're also joined by Brian Ashworth, an American Christian missionary and businessman living in Bangor, and Alan Leonard, a policy officer for the Alliance Party, who's here today in a private capacity. He's also a Democrat voter. You're also very welcome indeed to the programme. First, though, let's talk to one of the authors of The Right Nation, John Micklethwaite. He's in our studio in Shropshire this lunchtime. John, you're welcome.
Hello.
Thank you for taking part. First of all, in relation to America, the right nation, to be a conservative in the US at the moment, what do you have to believe in?
I think you have to believe in actually quite a different set of priorities to what you believe in England if you're a conservative. You have to believe it's a much more kind of optimistic creed in a strange sort of way, certainly a much more belligerent creed in other ways. It's also a creed which is defined much more by values than it is by sort of economic class. If you look at Britain or you look at most European countries, it tends to be the richer people who vote conservative. The best way of telling whether somebody is a conservative in America is actually to measure things like the amount of times they go to church and stuff like that. If you look at the way that the split between George Bush last time and Al Gore, if you look at the amount of people George Bush won above $100,000, with income above $100,000, George Bush was ahead of Al Gore, but not by much. If you look at the split amongst the number of times they went to church, for people who went once or more times a week, then Bush won overwhelmingly.
And that's reflected very much.
That's a fundamental difference.
Yeah, and that's reflected very much in George Bush himself, how important religion is to him.
It's a very important factor. I think if you look at Bush, his early life was something of a wastrel, and religion was one way in which he found it back. I think you can sometimes exaggerate it. People tend to look at the religion and tend to ascribe everything to that. I think that's a big mistake. But it's a fundamental core part of his personality. It's, you know, he begins each day praying. There's a prayer before every cabinet meeting. It's basically a different sort of White House to any kind of other government building, certainly in Western Europe. And it's not just that Bush is a conservative by American standards, it's that particular conservative bit of America is completely different, really, to Western Europe and its values, for better or worse.
In relation to George Bush, as we say, deep down, he is a conservative. Is he the best person at the helm of this conservative movement in America, or the best puppet for its masters?
I don't think he's a puppet, Bush. If you meet Bush, it's perfectly obvious that he's not, which I have done, it's perfectly obvious that he's not a puppet of anybody. He's much cleverer than he appears, at least in public. He's much more straightforward. The way the White House is run is very much with Bush actually running things at the center. There's no doubt that Cheney plays an important role, but every time that Cheney's stepped out of order, Bush has hit him back. He's not really a details person. I think that would be unfair to call him that. But he does have a very clear sense of where he's going. And going back to your original question of whether Bush is the ideal person to lead this, I think in one way you can argue he is the most conservative president America has yet produced in several ways. I mean, Reagan still remains the hero of what we call the right nation. But if you look at Reagan's stance on a whole series of social issues, such as abortion, such as sort of gay rights and stuff like that, he tended to play that type of thing much more easily than George W. Bush. I mean, Reagan was an easygoing divorcee from Hollywood, a little bit in the Schwarzenegger mold. He didn't tend to make quite so much of these social issues. He did enough to keep Christian conservatives happy, but Bush comes across as very much more one of that part of the right in America than Reagan was. So to that extent, I think Bush is the most conservative president they've yet had.
John, some people might think that this conservative movement in America has grown up since 9/11, since that country was under attack and was attacked so dreadfully that month. But really, it's been going on for a lot longer than that.
It's really a product of two things. One is a series of sort of fundamentally American values, which in some ways make it more conservative, as we see it. Religion has been right there in America, right from the very, very beginning. So has capitalism. It was partly founded by companies. On the other hand, if you go to the 1950s, you find a time when liberalism, as Americans call sort of left-wing progressives, seemed to be generally in charge of things. you had technically a Republican president in the shape of Eisenhower. But there was one time where somebody said that he was a conservative. Eisenhower reacted furiously and said, "How dare you call me that? I'm a right-thinking liberal like everyone else." And the same thing happened to Herbert Hoover shortly before that. Back in the 1950s, there wasn't a conservative movement as there is now. But since then, gradually, a much more powerful and also much more kind of aggressive in the sense of actually having a positive agenda conservative movement has grown up. If you look at conservatism on this side of the Atlantic, it tends to be about protecting the past. But if you look at something like Reagan, or you look at Newt Gingrich, or even to some extent you look at George W. Bush, they're not really about protecting the past, they're about trying to change the future. And I think the only European conservative who's come close to being an American-style conservative was actually Margaret Thatcher. And she was basically, I think, an American conservative who just by an accident of fate happened to be born in Grantham, not Houston.
John, you're staying with us for a discussion, a further in-depth discussion on this topic. Let me bring in the panel at this point. Alan Leonard, from what you've heard from John, what you've read from his book, is this the America that you recognize?
No. So there's a few comments that he makes, his observations, and I think it confuses some of the definitions of what he calls conservative on economic matters versus social matters. I find it incredible to hear that the 1950s was an era of liberalism in America. I think what the way I understand it is there's a difference between being economic liberal and socially liberal. There's no question that the 1950s was a time of social conservatism in America, but yes, economically liberal in the sense that the government balanced its books, it didn't hugely subsidize, you know, the military. Eisenhower warned of the military-industrial complex, whereas now it's all turned around, and you have conservatives who can be socially tolerant of minority issues, but they also behave like Keynesians in that the government will subsidize the military, give tax breaks to companies and the rest. So it is a different era than the 1950s, but I do think there's a confusion between being economically liberal, sort of left-right, and then socially liberal as well.
Brian Ashworth, do you believe that the majority of Americans are conservative?
Yes, I do. I believe that, well, for a start, John cited a poll that said 41% of Americans claim to be conservative. And being from Texas myself, I mean, I was right in the middle of it. I grew up in it. I consider myself a product of it. And definitely, you know, there is a strain that runs through all of America. There's a lot of liberals, say, in the likes of Los Angeles and New York and, you know, some of the East Coast and West Coast and things like that. But when you get down to small town America, you know, you're talking about the moral majority of people right there. And there's a strong conservatism and a lot of churchgoers, you know, a lot of Christians. I came from churches there in my late teens that were 3,000 strong, 5,000 strong in Houston, 10,000 strong in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You know, very large churches, a lot of Christian influence, you know, politically as well upon America. So that's kind of the America that I know and that I was raised in, definitely.
And if that is the case, Brian, then why didn't George Bush win the popular vote last time round? Because he didn't.
Yeah, so well, America is in a war at the moment, really, socially, morally. There's a lot of very active liberals and liberal lobbying groups, and there's a lot of people in America that are bucking that moral trend and the influence of Christianity and televangelists and what have you. I don't know, you know, when it comes right down to it, there's still a goodness in America that I think runs right across the board. They may not like George Bush, and maybe they wanted Gore, but definitely, I think as John said in an interview that I heard, you know, there is a shift to the right generally in America.
Just to explain, I mean, the point of our book, when we call it The Right Nation, that's particularly about the conservative bit of America, but we're not trying to claim for a second that all Americans are conservatives. What we are claiming, and I think which is extremely difficult to disagree with, is that American politics has generally drifted to the right under a whole series of different debates, which we could go through from the 1960s right the way through to now, and that America now has a much bigger conservative movement than any other country. And lastly, because of that, the center of politics in America is further to the right than it is elsewhere. So I have no problem at all with the idea that John Kerry could well win the next election. It's very difficult to win an election if you're running a war fairly badly and the economy is not going very well. So Kerry could win, but the type of policies that Kerry would pursue would still be massively more conservative than those of most European nations.
Well, we'll talk more about that.
I think is essentially what we're trying to get across.
We'll talk more about that later in the discussion about what the outcome of November's elections might mean on that front. Fionnuala, is it necessarily bad that America is more conservative, if that is the case?
It's something that I'm very uncomfortable with. I think the religious rights capacity for extremism and intolerance is really distasteful. Just in looking into this subject, I've discovered that since the Bush administration started, dozens of far-right Christian fundamentalists have been quietly installed in key positions within the Department of Health and Human Services, the Federal Drug Administration, and on commissions and advisory committees where they have made serious progress. So it's that kind of Christian fundamentalism that's infiltrating the administration that particularly bothers me.
Why?
Well, I mean, it's this sort of stealth war on a whole range of rights. In particular, the administration seems to be very keen to shut down on reproductive rights, on gay rights, but in this very, very kind of stealthy way, you know, and I find that really quite repugnant.
Newton, what's your view on this?
Well, I don't think that George Bush's war on those particular rights has been particularly stealthy. He has actually attempted to have the Constitution amended over gay marriage, which is just about as unstealthy a move as American politics can stomach. I think that the categories that this book's talking about may be becoming outdated even as they're becoming recognised. I'm sure John remembers Francis Fukuyama's book, The End of History, which came out after the fall of the Soviet Union, and that suggested that the ideological battles of the world had been won and politics from now on would just be a management exercise. It's very difficult, as anyone in Northern Ireland can tell you, to talk about a victory, and very dangerous as well. If the American right is now in the ascendant, its own internal contradictions will become very, very cruelly exposed as it becomes the core of the political system, and the conflict between American liberalism, American right-wing liberalism, economic liberalism, economic freedom, freedom to travel, freedom of the press, and so on, and the religious right will open up very widely. Now, Ronald Reagan, as John mentioned before, like many presidents in that mould, very carefully glossed over that divide with this attitude, as John Kerry said, of hoping we were on God's side rather than claiming, you know, mm-hmm. to be on God's side, or hoping God was on God's side. Well, Bush has blown a hole over that consensus, that quiet consensus across the entire American political system, to just keep a lid on that and not address it. By going head on with that debate, he's going to fracture the American right in a way that will probably create the new political system of the next 20 years in America.
Do you agree with that, John?
Well, I suppose obviously not. I think there's a big difference. I'd love to be compared to Francis Fukuyama, not least in book sales, but I think there is a big difference. What we're saying is, look, this is the progress the right has made over the past 40, 50 years, which I think is unquestionable. On the other hand, you know, we do make absolutely clear that there is fantastic contradictions within conservative America, and you alluded to some. I mean, just look at the gap between, say, Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, and John Ashcroft, the attorney general. It's very difficult to think of anything they agree on, other than in theory that government should be smaller, and also to some degree of solidity behind the war on terrorism. All coalitions tend to have their contradictions and their imperfections. But what I think is true is that this particular half of conservative America has shown a fantastic ability to come back into action whenever it gets defeated. Remember, Clinton walloped George Bush Sr., but within about a couple of years, the Republicans are back in charge, grabbing hold of Congress in the Gingrich Revolution. The one advantage of having a movement is that it does have some ability to replenish itself. It could be, you could just be right, that things are beginning to swing back towards the left. And there's certainly no doubt that if you wander around conservative America, like I've had to do for the last couple of years, and you talk to lots of conservative Americans, they don't think they're winning. They say, look at the, you know, everything, as we point out in the books, the sales of Girls Gone Wild videos, or the amount that they see government increasing under a Republican president in the shape of George W. Bush. All these things give them the impression that they're not winning, that things are going the other way. And yet, by most standards, they managed to move the debate fantastically from one side of the sort of 1960s general consensus to what the consensus in American politics is now. If you look at John Kerry, it's remarkable that he's perhaps the only significant American politician who is at least theoretically against the death penalty, although he waffles quite a lot about applying it to terrorists. Back in the 1960s, there was actually a majority of the American people who were against the death penalty. And it's sort of swinging those sort of issues in their directions that conservatives have been remarkably successful. But there is no, it's very difficult to project the future. And we set out lots of ways in which the right nation could fail to dominate American politics in the same ways it has done over the past 20 years for the next 20 years. But I still think that the odds, for various complicated reasons, are basically on its side.
Alan, what about that point that John made earlier, that John Kerry, regardless of who occupies the Oval Office, that the policies which they will pursue and enact will vary very little from what policies are in place at the moment?
Well, as Einstein said, everything is relative. I think if you're looking at policies that any American president are going to pursue, they don't seem to be terribly imaginary to European politicians. In a way, I actually think that America is conservative and always has been, in the sense that it's, the epitome of a capitalist society. It's for a long time free market reigned, everything, the federal structure, which the authors do mention. So in a sense, if you're looking at policies that even a Democrat are going to pursue, they're not going to be that terribly exciting to European.
So are Democrats effectively conservative as well?
Well, see, everything's relative. If you're looking at, say, European countries that have socialism, if you're looking at European nations that have gone through fascism, communism, America's never gone through any of this. And I think that American history is a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, in the sense that the Great Depression of the 1930s was probably the most dangerous time for America. If there was any time that America was going to go socialist, it was going to be then, but it didn't. Now, a lot of people criticized President Roosevelt for being so interventionist, but I actually believe that he saved America from becoming a socialist nation. So you can't really compare, we're not comparing the same things here. So to any European observer, a so-called liberal Democrat in America is going to seem conservative to them.
Brian.
Right. Yeah, I believe them. I mean, they purged communism because of strong conservative beliefs, that they had the trials, the witch hunts and everything like that, hunting every communist they could find. And after that, I mean, the enemy became the liberals. And the liberals began stealthily to get into the academic world, the universities, the media, Hollywood, all the movies and things like that, and that's what the conservatives have felt attacked by ever since, as well as liberal loading of the judicial system. And that's one of the things that Bush has been trying to counter. He has been actually trying to put conservative Christian, traditional values, and people with traditional values and beliefs into positions of authority like the judicial system. I mean, a lot of the liberal decisions in American politics, which have influenced our nations, I mean, decisions on abortion and decisions on whether or not God should play a part in public life and prayer in schools and all this sort of thing, wasn't those things were not allowed or forbidden because of congressional votes. They were dealt with in the Supreme Court, and where you had a 5-4 decision or something like that, where you have a handful of people in the United States deciding that abortion should be allowed, against the vast majority of people who are pro-life in America and who don't believe that unborn children should be pulled out of the womb with forceps or whatever. So a lot of the liberal decisions that took place were in the court systems and not in Congress. And so the conservatives have felt under attack, and they do feel like they have been sort of losing the war. They're in a battle right now to regain lost ground. And that has been a tremendously mobilizing factor within the conservative movement, that they are standing up to say, no, we're bringing America back, to the morality of, because it's driven by Christians, I mean, the morality of the Word of God and right to life and family values. I mean, the liberals would say that a parent shouldn't have the right to know or consent to their teenage daughter having an abortion, and the liberals would say, no, that teenage daughter has a right to have an abortion. Okay. Without parental consent or knowledge.
Finola.
I just, this kind of smug certainty that we know what these moral absolutes are and that they're God-given. And I mean, even to use a phrase like God playing a part in public life, I don't understand what that means. You know, I mean, what could that mean? You know, Bush recently said things, you know, things like, I trust God speaks through me. Without that, I couldn't do my job. I was finding out that, you know, White House aides called Bush and Attorney General John Ashcroft, himself a Christian fundamentalist, who shares many of Bush's strict religious convictions, the Blues Brothers, because, like the characters, they believe they're on a mission from God. And I just, you know, these phrases that are being used here, you know, unborn children pulled out of the womb with forceps, they're so inflammatory. They're so, they're designed to disgust people at this really visceral level, but all in the name of, we're doing this for God, we're on God's side. And I just find that absolutely terrifying.
Well, now I think we're getting to the heart of the issue here, the American culture war. I mean, John's asked in his book, what makes America different? The answer, I think, is obvious. America is the only country in human history ever founded on ideas. And that means that battles over ideas are extremely dangerous, potentially very divisive in that country. And it also means that there is an extent to which you can be very easily judged as more or less American, un-American, if you like, depending on your beliefs on certain liberal or conservative issues. And then, of course, we have the issue of the Supreme Court as well. It's a very, very interesting constitutional mechanism in America. There is a sense in which the Supreme Court really is the cultural heart of the country. Presidents appoint Supreme Court judges for life, maybe only one or two during their entire presidency. And they interpret the Constitution and they decide very much the tone of the nation. And they decide it, much like the House of Lords has an effect on the House of Commons. It sort of lags the public by about a generation or two. And so you'll find that the Supreme Court was slightly more conservative than the American general public 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And now it's slightly more liberal. And it acts almost like a sort of brake, you know, making sure that change doesn't become too rapid. And it's a little bit disingenuous of Brian to suggest that the Supreme Court is a liberal Trojan horse, because you can be sure that George Bush will be stuffing the Supreme Court with religious lunatics just as enthusiastically as any president before him ever installed, you know, bleeding heart liberals.
Can I come in and try to explain the paradox of religion in America? Because living over here, it does seem to me interesting. People don't understand how America has a separation of church and state, and yet it's always portrayed as a land of a bunch of religious lunatics. I mean, I remember recently I saw a French documentary, and it was just clip after clip of President Bush and his cabinet going to prayer, Congress going to prayer, and they said, look at America, it's a religious, you know, fanaticism. Mm-hmm. But again, like Newt was saying, America was founded on ideas and religious freedoms. And you had a wide variety of religions who, being persecuted in Europe, came to America. The only way a system like that was going to work is if you installed a kind of federalist system. And it was true. I mean, one could argue that the American colonies were just as sectarian as any other sectarian part of the world, and that if you were a Quaker, you went to one state, you went to a Puritan, you know, if you, whatever religion you were, you went to a particular colony because that's where you found your religious freedom. So there is no established Church of America, but yes, there is very much, you know, within the right movement, Christians together, evangelicals and the rest, who do want to win this cultural morality war. But let's not confuse this war of culture over religion.
John.
No, I agree with that very much. The culture war is wider than just religion. I think, you know, the great aim of our book, allegedly, one thing that's been well received in America, is the idea that we've approached the conservative movement as objectively as you humanly can. And from that perspective, I'd say that, you know, Brian, I think, is wrong to say that the Supreme Court, that most people are pro-life in America. Virtually every poll shows most people favouring abortion rights in some favour. But I think he is broadly correct to the extent that the Supreme Court, most of the polling evidence in the 60s and 70s shows the Supreme Court, far from being a kind of brake on progressive policy, on the whole being a sort of accelerator of it, is it pushed not just on abortion, but a whole series of rulings on things like pornography, various things to do with prisoners. It was a bit like the sort of 1960s liberal experiments on this side of the Atlantic. Those things pushed it forward, and that did certainly rile up conservative America. I mean, you have to go back to this idea. Again, I'm sorry to correct the gentleman who thought that America was sort of profoundly had a big conservative movement in the 1950s. You know, back in the 1950s, as far as one can work out, fewer than sort of one in 20 people regarded themselves as conservative. most people regard themselves as liberals, albeit they may have lived very conservative lives, but that was the phrase they used. Now you have twice as many conservatives as liberals, which would have shocked people like Eisenhower. They would never possibly have understood that. And what you see now, I think, is a sort of... There was that group of people who were riled, I think, by the 1960s. There was also the question of the South, where you traditionally had whites in the South tended to vote for the Democrats, and they swung behind the Republicans, in part because of the Civil Rights Acts. And you see fundamentally a kind of different version of a more stridently ideological party coming through. And what's interesting about America, to go back to the idea about ideas, is that the Democrats and Republicans fundamentally were not parties of ideas until the 1960s. Before then, you could meet Southern Democrats who were far more conservative than Northern Republicans. And then it was around that time that things began to push each way. And the conservatives, like Brian, I think have got a decent case on this point, the idea that there was a sort of degree of liberal activism in the 1960s, and I use that word without prejudice, which sort of riled up conservative America into getting some kind of movement of its own. And that had profound effects, and that's what we tried to catalogue.
And John, you don't believe that John Kerry in the Oval Office would make any real difference, do you?
I think if you look at it from an international perspective, no. I mean, look at the Kyoto Accords, the International Criminal Court, all the things which... I mean, what I think will happen is if Kerry wins, which I agree is quite likely. I have a disagreement with my co-author. He thinks Kerry will win, and I still narrowly think Bush will win. But whichever way you take it, if you wander around the smarter people in Washington, you'll probably find them... At the moment, you'll probably find them slightly backing Kerry, but every single one of them will say they could work out it could go either way. I think if Kerry were to win, I think Europeans initially would be wildly happy, and in fact you could argue there might even be a beneficial response effect of that happiness, is you might see slightly more European involvement, continental European involvement in Iraq and places like that. But fundamentally, on a lot of the issues that Europe does not like Bush over, Kerry's not that much different. He's much harder line, at least in theory, than Bush on Israel. He's equally hard line on the Kyoto Accord. He's hard line on the International Criminal Court. All these various different issues, which are actually the arguments at the moment underneath the transatlantic alliance, and those, I think, Kerry wouldn't make much difference. I mean, at home, he's talking about fiddling around with the tax structure a bit and taking away some money from people who earn over, I think it's over $200,000 a year, and putting that into a half attempt at a sort of national health service, or via health insurance. If he does that, that would count as a sort of biggish, a small liberal achievement. But apart from that, there really isn't much change. He's saying, I'm going to be like Bush, but I'm going to be a slightly cosier version of it. I'm still going to propagate the war on terrorism.
Newton, is there a perception, though, that John Kerry is a liberal?
Well, there is a perception that John Kerry would be a better president than George Bush, but as far as I can tell, a lot of this is based on prejudice, on a prejudice against Americans, against America. I think if John's book achieves anything positive, it will be to help people to understand that America is a foreign country. They may be white and speak English and watch the same television as us and sell the same their television to us, but people don't really think of America as a foreign country and treat it as such with the respect that it deserves. You would never speak about the religious beliefs of, say, the Nepalese president with the scorn and disdain that you hear people talking about the religious beliefs of the American president, simply because we feel that we feel so familiar with Texans that familiarity has bred contempt.
But the Nepalese president doesn't wield as much power around the world as George Bush does.
Well, that's true, of course, but that's not the basis of the sneering. The content of the sneering, as Alan was pointing out from that French documentary he had watched, is oh my God, look at this gauche cowboy. He's so unsophisticated. He doesn't measure up to our standards of cultural intellectualism. And yet, I can assure you that nobody who becomes leader of the free world is a moron. You can't do it, no matter what sort of intelligence, cultural or otherwise, you have to use to get to that position. You are a smart man, and you know, you have thought through your decisions. So I think that perhaps if John Kerry is elected and turns out really in substance to be very little different, it might help people to understand that they are dealing with a completely foreign culture, and not just wayward cousins, which is still the patronising attitude taken to American politics in this country.
And Fionnuala, is that radical conservative movement, that steering towards the right that we've been talking about, is that what provokes the anti-Americanism from the rest of the world, from Europe?
I think so, and I'm very impressed with Newt defending George Bush's right to be a complete head-banging fundamentalist, you know, I mean, and standing up for him in the face of the sneering that goes on. But I also think, you know, he's making the point that, you know, America's a foreign country, they do things differently there, and that may hold up to a point, but I also think we're very, very familiar with that brand of Christian fundamentalism much closer to home. We see it very much here in Northern Ireland, and informs much political thinking on social issues here in Northern Ireland. And again, it comes back to that kind of complacency on, you know, just seeing everything in terms of black and white issues. And that's what fundamentalists do. They see things in terms of certainties, in terms of easy answers, and it leads to these kind of rigid ideologies. So I think there's a lot of very illuminating parallels to be drawn between our own situation here in Northern Ireland and that in the States.
Brian, that question that I put to Fionnuala, is that a fair point, that it is because of this conservatism that the rest of the world, and I suppose especially Europe, have this anti-American attitude?
Oh, I would say definitely people don't understand where the certainty comes from. You know, they don't understand the moral conviction of America. I mean, but you have to understand America was founded, you know, by Puritans, by the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and the Great Awakening in the 1700s, and Charles Wesley and John Wesley and different revivals. And, you know, you just have to understand that they are a very strong Christian nation in many ways, okay, battling with the liberal elements within. So in Europe, on the other hand, as John, I heard him once say, you know, has not experienced this kind of movement in Europe. I mean, say Northern Ireland had a revival in 1859, that we're still experiencing the effects of that today, you know, in policy and what have you. I hate the fractious elements of the Christian, you know, Christians and churches in Northern Ireland today. I don't like that at all. In the United States, they're much more united in so many more ways. But, you know, we're still experiencing the effects of that in 1859, even now. But the rest of Europe and say, Britain in general, has not experienced a move of God like that. I mean, the general traditional churches are just, you know, their pews are empty. Mm-hmm. You're getting a lot of independent churches springing up now, which are much more lively, and they're drawing more people. But Europe on the whole, I mean, needs another Christian movement. Just, you know, it's desperate for it, really. Because they don't realize how liberal they are, you know, in so many different areas. There's a tremendous, you know, shift to the left in the politics in Britain and Europe in general. So you're talking about socialism and the values of socialism and what have you. They're so different from, you know, American conservatism. And I think that, you know, you have to understand that to really grasp the differences, why we're different.
John, you also explored in the book how this conservatism is viewed by the rest of the world. What impact does it have?
I think it's huge. I think actually it's very educational in a weird way. I'm having somebody like Brian on the program because I think people, time and time again, I've wandered around Europe and you get told that all the Christian right is just a group of, you know, they're thick and they tend to be from the white trash living somewhere down south. You go to a place like Texas, the gleaming new mega churches, they're not built in the sort of shacks, they're built in the smartest suburbs. These are clever, sophisticated, smart people, and they're people who are completely foreign to Europeans, because I think for several reasons. Like Europeans, firstly, they don't go to what we call the right nation. If you look at the places where Europeans visit in America, they visit New York, Washington, Boston, Los Angeles, San Francisco. Well, you've just listed the sort of five of the biggest liberal cities in America. It's the area in between, a bit like that one which you just had the news item about, the biker, mm-hmm. who's gone across America. The runner who's gone across America. Well, I can guarantee you that he spent more time in Republican territory than he has in Democratic territories he went across. I think another big reason is that during the Cold War, it was somehow helped us in some ways. There were definitely rows in America. Look at the problems over cruise missiles and things like that. But on the whole, people didn't really look at Americans too closely to work out where they actually stood. And to the extent at the time, I think the ruling class in America, although that's a dangerous word to use, were trying to Europeanize America. People felt some degree of affinity. You had sort of Kennedy boasting about having been to London School of Economics and studying under a communist and stuff like that. That would just never have happened at the moment. I think what's happening now is people are slightly, now the Cold War's over, it's taken some time. I think here there is a little bit of Fukuyama territory. I think people are just suddenly looking at each other, or contra Fukuyama territory. People are looking at each other and saying, actually, we are actually very different. We're not the same. You know, there's different sets of beliefs. We were great allies in that war. And the real big question at the moment is to what extent we are allies in the war against terrorism, to what extent we share absolutely the same kind of priorities that we did in the war against communism. And I think, for reasons which are both bad and good, the same sense of alliance is not there over the question of the war on terrorism.
Alan, just a final thought from you on this. After everything we've heard, is it more an America that you recognize now, or do you feel like in the minority in your country?
No, excuse me. No, I grew up in the Midwest, in Ohio, and spent my university years in Boston, the so-called liberal bastion. In the Midwest, I was deridedly nicknamed as a communist because I didn't vote Republican. And then when I moved out to the East Coast, I lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which has the nickname the People's Republic of Cambridge because they have outrageous things like proportional representation. So, no, it's the America I recognize. I will be voting for Kerry. I think at the end of the day, the comments made about the Supreme Court are very apt. I think the biggest differences between America and many other places of the world is our separation of powers and the differences between the executive, legislative, and judicial branches, how long it takes to actually pass laws, and the danger, of course, when laws are passed too quickly, like the Patriot Act, which does concern me. It is an America I recognize, but it doesn't mean I'm complacent about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we leave this discussion here. John, thank you very much indeed for joining us this lunchtime. John Micklethwaite and his and the co-author Adrian Wooldridge, their book, The Right Nation, Why America is Different. It will be published next Thursday by Penguin, and it will cost you £14.99. Now, while the road to the White House may be full of obstacles for both presidential candidates, the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, didn't allow any to get in the way of his holiday at the palatial home of the Italian head of state, Silvio Berlusconi, earlier this week. Many denounced the Blairs for accepting the company and the largesse of Mr. Berlusconi, described by some as the new Mussolini. To tell us why this was such a bad judgment call for the Blairs, on the line now is the Observer columnist Nick Cohen, who's been keeping an eye on the Prime Minister's holidays in recent years. Nick, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Now, it's a very nice villa, very nice food and wine, everything you want at your fingertips. Why wouldn't he go?
It was entirely predictable he would go, but if you work on the maxim of you judge people by the company they keep, it fits into a pattern with the Prime Minister of just being massively overimpressed by very sleazy, very wealthy men. These are the people he looks up to in many ways and who he chooses to spend his time with. I mean, in many ways, of course, Berlusconi is by far and away the sleaziest in that he's got virtually a whole country under his control. He owns virtually all the commercial television, controls the state television as Prime Minister, controls most of the press, uses control of Parliament to push through laws that stop investigations into allegations of fraud against him. And you would have thought, I mean, coming as I do from a sort of Labour culture in Britain, that no one associated with the Labour Party would want to spend a holiday with someone like that. As a matter of choice, they would find it all very tacky and be a bit embarrassed to be in the presence of someone who, in Berlusconi's case, actually has what are called post-fascist parties in his cabinet.
And yet Berlusconi keeps being re-elected.
Yes. This drives Italians I know to despair, because there was this greatest effort initially after the fall of the Berlin Wall, you know, to clean the mafia out of politics, to clean it up, and then when finally, and it seemed to have some success, a lot of people died in the fight to do it. Finally, after all of that, the Italians elect someone who's got far more continuity with the old regime. But of course, Berlusconi's enemies are the allies of the Labour Party in Europe. They're the Italian Socialists, the Italian Social Democrats, and they are furious about this. There have been resolutions to expel the Labour Party from the, if you like, left of centre grouping of European parties. People are just in despair about his behavior, because it helps Berlusconi. It makes him, you know, a lot of people view Berlusconi as just a clown, really, and an idiot.
But it gives him some legitimacy, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And the two men, though, haven't always been close. There was quite a standoff between them a number of years ago. How have they become close in the meantime?
Well, yes, you should never be too prissy about this for politicians. Any politician, anyone high up in any organization has to do business with people that, on the whole, they wouldn't like. And at the start with Blair and Berlusconi, that appeared to be the case. If you looked at the body language in the photographs, Blair was very stiff, very formal, a bit like when he met Gaddafi about a year ago. What's changed? Two things, I think. First of all, the war in Iraq, where Italy was involved, so Blair's grateful for that. Second, I just get this sense, with Blair having survived the Iraq controversy, is the lesson he's drawn from that is not that he's got to appease his own supporters and behave. The lesson he's drawn from it is he can do whatever he wants, and he will get away with it, and he'll never be punished either by his party or by the electorate, which is rather a dangerous thing for a prime minister to think, I believe. But you can see in other things, like his decision to bring Peter Mandelson back. Now, leaving aside everything else, that just upsets an awful lot of Labour supporters who can't stand Mandelson. I think, why has this man been given the third chance? Blair doesn't care. Again, there's a significant, not huge, but sort of liberal middle-class band of Labour support who just regard anyone who wants to holiday with Silvio Berlusconi as completely beyond the pale. But again, why should he care? He's not going to be hurt. And I think that does seem to be the dominating thing in the Prime Minister now. He thinks he's got the luck of the devil, and he doesn't have to behave as a normal politician would have to behave.
Has he been the guest of other countries' leaders in the past?
Not so much leaders. There's very rich men, and he and Sherry always seem to be on the lookout for freebies. They're worse than journalists, really. There was a count in Tuscany who, again, was very, very right-wing. There was Geoffrey, the owner of the New States, which I actually worked for, but it's a clear interest, Geoffrey Robertson, who's got huge villas, but then they fell out. Cliff Richard, obviously. There does seem to be this kind of taste of the Blairs for the trashy rich, if you like, which I think reflects a slightly wider breakdown, and certainly in England, in the English. The old English progressive middle class was rather segregated from the rest of the middle class. They would go on holidays to the Lake District and youth hostel and cycle, and there was a definite culture. And that's, and you can see people like Harold Wilson going on holidays in the Scilly Isles and places like that, you know, very English, and the sort of thing that an English middle-class centre-left family would do. Now, like a lot of his contemporaries who've all made vast amounts of money in the media and places like that, there's certainly this taste for sort of rather trashy celebrity and very expensive culture.
Okay, Nick, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for that. Nick Owen there of The Observer on Tony Blair's holiday arrangements this year. Fionnuala, have you any objection to who Tony Blair spends his time with in the guise of Silvio Berlusconi?
Yeah, I mean, I just think the whole thing, as Nick says, is a bit yucky. Berlusconi is one of the most unconventional and controversial political leaders in the world stage. As Nick says, there's these consistent accusations against his government that they're made up of black shirts and white collars, you know, former fascists and white collar criminals. And so certainly by going on holiday with Berlusconi, Blair sends a very powerful message. It can't be just seen as an innocent act. This act will signify. And again, I think it's indicative of Blair's kind of messianic tendencies, you know, this kind of, you know, this remarkable capacity to convince himself of this moral rectitude of his own actions, but effectively it's morally bankrupt in my view. Last time I was on this program, we were talking about the moral implications of the Butler report. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is just more of the same. It's Blair's contempt for public opinion, it's this messianic high-handedness that I find awful, and Blair really gets up my nose. And to be honest, as for Cherie, she's pretty venal herself, you know, this woman who goes on eBay and buys second-hand toys for her kids, you know, it's just like, come on.
Newton, what's your view?
Well, I'd like to thank Nick Cohen for that hilarious insight into the weird old-fashioned PG Woodhouse world of the Guardian set. I mean, he may have a point within his own family argument, if you like, but it's beside the point. The problem with Blair is not who he holidays with, but that he holidays with foreign leaders at all. If he had taken Nick Cohen's advice and snubbed Berlusconi, that would also have been a problem. You have to ask, why do we have a foreign secretary? Why do we have a foreign service? Why a foreign office? Why do we have a diplomatic corps? It's in order to distance the leader of our country from the relationships that country enjoys with other states, to keep them professional hundreds of years of diplomatic practice and experience have gone into maintaining that professional distance, and Blair just steamrollers through it because he thinks he can run British foreign policy like an Islington dinner party. He thinks he can be chummy with Berlusconi, he can be on first name terms with Jack Chirac and Jack Welask after the kids. This is cringe-makingly amateurish stuff. We need a Prime Minister who deals with other countries at a respectful distance, so that when we fall out with their governments or when we have a disagreement, we can deal with them properly. So that when we have a problem, for example, over Gibraltar, as we're going to have now with Spain, the fact that he was cozying up to the previous government isn't going to create, as it has done, a major rift with the new government. Blair needs to step back, allow the professionals to deal with these relationships, and stop being so touchy-feely and personal. He cannot run the world like it is his set of friends.
Brian, it's been said that Berlusconi is not that far away from Mugabe in the sense that changing the law to protect himself from being prosecuted. Should Tony Blair be spending his holidays with him?
Well, I do believe in the right of someone to choose, you know, where they're going to spend their holidays and who they're going to spend it with. But, I mean, I wouldn't have spent it with Berlusconi. I mean, I wouldn't. In recent times seem to be with people, okay, they're moneyed and what have you, but they also have villas and small castles and what have you with a lot of security arrangements. And so I think possibly that could be a factor as well in a lot of his choices, you know, of destinations. So, I mean, I wouldn't like to think his life was endangered, you know, when he's going on holiday. So I wish my holidays were as nice as his.
Anyway. Yeah, well, absolutely. The villa sounds absolutely gorgeous. Alan, was it an error of judgment?
Well, if it's an error of judgment, it keeps repeating it. I mean, he's been on a number of trips. I mean, the trip to Mexico, the trip to Egypt. This is, sorry for the listeners, the whole issue about who pays for these trips. So he keeps, you know, doing this again and again without any real ramification. I was amused when Nick was talking about keeping company with sleazy, wealthy men. I thought, well, surely he's not making reference to Clive Richards.
to Clive Richards. Newton, why do you think Tony Blair does this? Is it, as Nick was suggesting, that he is so arrogant that he thinks he can get away with anything?
No, I think it's because he's so arrogant, he thinks that having a personal relationship with foreign leaders makes a difference. It does make a slight difference in that when those leaders are replaced, the new leaders feel suspicious about our government. You saw this, for example, in the way that when John Major also broke the rules and sent Conservative Party officers over to help in George Bush Sr.'s re-election campaign, Bill Clinton was very, very dicey about dealing with the British government. And that shows the lesson that Blair has not learned, that you must keep your distance. It's not about Berlusconi. He shouldn't be going on holiday with the leaders of other countries at all. I wonder sometimes if it reveals a blind spot in Tony Blair, a failure to realise that democratic leaders come and go, and that they're not the most important thing in a country's foreign policy in its dealing with other countries, that the purpose of foreign policy is to ease that transition between governments and amongst nations. He seems to think that he's above all that, and that is a very worrying sign.
Fionnuala, is there an expectation almost that if someone does spend a holiday of this largesse at such a beautiful villa and all expense that incurs, that a payback is expected at some point down the line?
I think so. As I say, it can never be a completely innocent act, and I think Blair's narcissism, as Newton says, it almost attempts to kind of transcend that. But that's what it comes back down to. That's the nitty gritty, and that's the nature of political relationships, and all the chumminess in the world between Blair and Berlusconi can't disguise that. But I did think it was absolutely hilarious the way Berlusconi was dressed, you know, wearing his bandana and exposing his tanned chest. You know,
do you know why he was wearing his bandana?
No, I don't know.
Well, apparently it was because he had received a hair transplant.
Oh, right, so he had to keep it covered up.
He did.
Smart move. But I just thought it was absolutely
followed
hilarious.
On because, last year.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously a completely butt-clenching moment for the Blairs, but then they deserved it, you know.
Newton, who would you like to spend your holidays with?
Well, it wouldn't be Silvio Berlusconi, admittedly, although apparently he does have the most amazing villa in Italy. But, I mean, I think if I was the Prime Minister, and, you know, there is still time, I think that there should be a rule, perhaps, that Prime Ministers do not socialise at this level. I mean, we have cabinet positions, we have enormous branches of the civil service to deal with it. And I mean, in Tony Blair's position, if I can half imagine it, I'd like to think that that I wouldn't leave the country on holiday at all. There are good reasons not to, security as well as political. And also, of course, the temptation to go away from domestic politics and hobnob with in the glamorous world of international politics has always been a danger for democratic leaders right across the Western world. It has always been a big part of their drift out of power and away from public popularity in Britain, in America, in all the European countries. And Tony Blair is just a sucker for it.
Brian, but does it really matter where the Prime Minister spends his holiday? He's entitled to some time off. And where in the UK would you get weather and the rest of it like he's getting in Italy, for goodness sake?
Well, you've definitely got to travel to get the better weather. Does it matter? Again, you know, if you're Prime Minister and, you know, you want to support your economy and, you know, put in your two bits, spend your money in Britain, maybe you should spend some time in Britain. If I had a favorite holiday, I might, you know, if with a world leader, I might go where all the other world leaders go, Crawford, Texas.
Crawford, Texas.
30 minutes up the road from my hometown, so.
Where George Bush spends an awful lot of his time, doesn't he, Alan? He goes on holiday quite a bit, doesn't he?
Well, of course, before September 11, he was criticized for spending so much of his term on vacation.
Finola, who would you spend your holiday with if you had to choose?
Well, do you know who I'd go for? I'd go for John Prescott. Bit of brawn there, action man for the 21st century. You know, he'd be perfect because, you know, if you fell in the hotel pool, he'd pull you out.
He'd be there.
He'd deck anybody who might hassle you in the bar, and there'd definitely be plenty of food. So I'd go for John.
Finola, have you ever spent a weekend in Hull?
I have.
Maybe I need to rethink. Not very nice.
Newton, have you had any bad experiences on holidays with people who you have stayed with and would have preferred not to at the end of it? No names.
Oh, that really puts me on the spot. I think fish and guests smell after 3 days, as they say in Japan, and I think you can definitely overstay your welcome. It comes to a point when you know, you've got to realise you're old enough now to pay for your own hotel room, and leave it at that.
Exactly. Well, we shall leave it at that for this Sunday lunchtime. Thanks to all of my guests for coming in and taking part today. Newton Emerson to Finola Meredith. Both of them will be back in the studio next week at 1 o'clock as well. Thanks to Brian Ashworth and Alan Leonard, to Nick Cohen and to John Micklethwaite. The producer today was Anne Mallon. So from her and from me, until another 7 days have passed, have a good week.